From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We can't do this without you. That's why we're so thankful for your support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Wednesday brings the Christian observance of Yule, celebrated as the Yule or Litha Solstice in the Wicca and pagan traditions. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
You know, we have immigrants in this country, both documented and undocumented. We've got dreamers who live in fear that their families will be torn apart by deportation.
With the holidays fast approaching, many of us are feeling lost and disoriented, frankly, thanks to the political climate in this country. I'm looking forward to the chance to ask a man who's no stranger to finding and sharing peace in a climate of adversity for his insights when I'm joined later in the hour by Right Reverend Bishop Gene Robinson.
I don't like to divide things by party or religious affiliation. Iowa, I believe, is about fairness and about these kind of Iowa values.
After an unparalleled career in activism for LGBT rights and religious freedom, Donna Redwing, once branded the most dangerous woman in America by the religious right, is retiring at the end of the year from her current position at the helm of One Iowa. We'll sit down to get her take on recent events and the prospects for civil rights going forward. But first,
you probably heard about the rise of fake news. Mm-hmm. Usually you can find fake news on websites that create stories that are completely false and get people to believe they're true.
Yes. Yeah.
A lot of the time they end up getting shared on social media sites like Facebook and Twitter. But it's important to know the difference between real stories and fake ones.
The incredible percentage of Americans that believe untruths, lies, falsehoods, call them whatever you will, just keeps growing. The nonprofit progressive watchdog Media Matters is dramatically shifting its focus in the coming year to take on the terrifying, effective specter of fake news. And joining me right now to explain why all of this is happening at Media Matters is their senior fellow, Eric Bollert. Eric, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me.
You've recently published an article calling out five people close to Trump who have propagated fake news. Please talk about that.
The problem with fake news is it played such a large role during the campaign, right? So the Washington Post, BuzzFeed, and others have done a pretty good job in terms of correlating and trying to measure just how important it was. And it really was kind of a land rush in the last 4, 6, 8 weeks when we saw the traffic numbers just exploding in terms of Facebook and Twitter and things like that. And in terms of the research today, the fake news was overwhelmingly pro-Trump and anti-Clinton. Mm-hmm. So it's not a problem that it seems to be affecting both sides of the political spectrum. It really seems to be a conservative problem. And the problem is it affects the rest of the political dialogue.
Yeah.
And so it's not just people kind of passing these around casually or your aunts and uncles kind of upgrading the email chain that they used to send around with some suspicious information. I mean, this was Donald Trump's son. It was retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who is now being tapped to run the National Security Agency, his son. During the heat of the campaign, they were sending out tweets about how Clinton supporters were being paid to attend rallies, how Hillary Clinton might be tied up with some kind of sex ring, and things like this. So stuff that was just kind of off the charts and stuff that has absolutely nothing to do with policy, had absolutely nothing to do with kind of what kind of president Trump or Clinton would be. Most of it was just very dark, ugly, kind of character assassination built around phony allegations, built around claims, you know, the FBI had just raided Hillary Clinton's office and things like that. So the problem escalated quickly during the last couple months of the campaign, and it was fueled by people who are now in the inner circle of the Trump team.
I'm seeing, and I know you've seen it too, astounding numbers about the propensity of people who voted for Trump to believe only what he says. We've seen documentation that 80% or so of these people believe that he won the popular vote, that there were millions of illegal voters in the election, and it doesn't matter what
That's
they
right.
see. So tell me, is there a way to get to those people, or do you just have to say, we're just going to try to get everybody else informed?
Well, that's a good question. And to be honest, I think it's very difficult to reach those people. There was just a poll out, I think it was South Carolina, Trump supporters, 60, 70, 80% want, you know, Muslims banned in America. 60% want gays banned from America. Over 50% want Islam to become illegal in the United States. I mean, you're not going to reach those people.
Right.
But what is important, I think, is to reach two main groups. Independent voters who are still, you know, engaged and smart and paying attention and, you know, can always use an education. And the mainstream media in terms of sending up these red flags, not letting them either get suckered in or not letting them deal with this issue casually, mm-hmm. and not to let them just kind of write it off as, well, that, you know, it's just kind of the crazy on the fringes doing this. And I'll give you a perfect example. I just wrote a piece on the press coverage of the Trump transition so far. And again, going back to Michael Flynn, who Trump wants to be his head of national security, mm-hmm. you know, a week before the election, he tweeted out an article. This was like a classic fake news article mm-hmm. that claimed Hillary Clinton was linked to sex crimes with children. Mm-hmm. Now, to me, if you're going to be doing that and then you get tapped to be national security, that would be a part of every profile any journalist would ever write about Michael Flynn.
Sure.
And we saw a flood of them, right? People didn't know who he was. Who is this guy? He's going to be an incredibly important job. Lots and lots of long profiles about Michael Flynn. I read them all for my research.
Yeah.
Virtually none of them mentioned that he had tweeted out a fake article claiming that Hillary Clinton was involved with sex crimes with children.
Yeah.
And that's crazy. I mean, that's got to be included in every single article about this guy. Because look, if a prominent Democrat during a campaign last month tweeting out 9/11 truther stuff,
mm-hmm.
and then President-elect Hillary Clinton wanted that person to be head of national security, I guarantee you that person's fake news tweets would be incredibly important. So it's important that the mainstream press, the D.C. press, doesn't try to downplay this stuff when senior people on the Trump team are engaged in it.
Do you see, Eric, any real pressure yet to stop this practice that seems to be working?
Like a lot of people who played a role in Hillary Clinton's defeat, decided to do something after the election. So Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, in the week after the election, said it was ridiculous to claim, you know, fake news stories that were spread on Facebook had anything to do with the election. Once some of the research started pouring in, Facebook definitely changed its message. They're addressing it. They still don't think they're to blame, of course. But they claim they want to do something about it. Google wants to do something about it. You know, I think the big question is there still going to be this major audience, right? This was kind of a perfect storm for people in the fake news business. And we've seen some good reporting. You know, Washington Post and others mm-hmm. have interviewed people who make their living doing this. And they said, oh, by the way, we tried to do it with liberals, but they didn't bite. They didn't take the bait. Mm-hmm. We did it with conservatives, you know, pushing out this anti-Clinton stuff, mm-hmm. and they started getting a million hits per article. So it's kind of a perfect storm for them. It was this perfect campaign. This villainous character in the person of Hillary Clinton was created, and Trump was this very unusual character who seemed to embrace lies and fake news himself. I think that one of the questions is post-election, what are the fake news stories going to be about, right? If Hillary Clinton leaves the stage, if your villain is gone, is there still going to be that appetite online?
Yeah.
Fake news about how great Donald Trump is, I'm not sure that's going to generate the same kind of traffic. So I think the people who monetized it, it'll be interesting to see how they're going to try to continue this momentum. The companies say they're going to try to do something about it. We don't know what that's going to look like software-wise or whatever. But hopefully, between them being proactive and hopefully between a change in the political landscape, there might be less of an appetite for this for now. But what happens next campaign, we don't know.
Eric, how does Media Matters plan to take on fake news more aggressively?
You know, we're going to research it more, and when we see it pop up, we're just going to try to shine a light on it, right? And let the mainstream media know. People kind of were caught flat-footed during the campaign, right? People didn't really know what was going on. You know, the press and a lot of people didn't understand the incredible importance this fake news stuff was having. And so now there's no excuse, right? Mm-hmm. If who knows what issue will come up, you know, in the early weeks and months of the Trump presidency. Mm-hmm. But if something is being fueled by a coordinated campaign of fake news, we're going to try to shine a light on it. We're going to hold the press accountable and say, look, you know, this is what's driving this discussion. This is what's driving these falsehoods. This is what's driving the misinformation. And there is no excuse for just sitting back and watching at this time. There needs to be an aggressive effort to combat it.
Is there a fact-checking role that social media users who desperately want to separate truth from fiction can play in this work?
Well, look, you know, as I said, you know, some of these people who make fake news for a living, specifically a couple of people said they tried to do it with the Bernie Sanders supporters. Mm-hmm. And the quote in the Washington Post from one of the guys was, you know, they'd float these stories and it would be debunked by the first or second comment, you know, the reader comment, and then it wouldn't go anywhere. So, you know, I think for a majority of the population, people are still able to understand true and false. If a story is too good to be true and it's coming from a source you've never heard of, odds are it's not true. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty easy to just click on the next article and do a little fact-checking on your own. But again, this is a larger cultural problem. Look, Fox News built its empire, misleading viewers for 20 years, certainly much more aggressively during the Obama years. And so there's a political culture among conservatives and sort of hardcore believers that, you know, if it's on Fox News, it's true. And then if you take that leap, if it's on Facebook, it's true. Or if it makes Hillary Clinton or Obama look like criminals, it's true. Those people they're committed, right?
Yeah.
And there may not be much we can do about them. But again, it's very important to shine a spotlight on this and make sure everyone else is aware of what's going on.
I'd like for you to tell our listeners how to support your work. I know they're concerned about this. We get questions about it. Give them information about how to listen or how to support your work.
Sure. The easiest way is just to visit us at mediamatters.org, and you can see all the items we put up each day, videos, transcripts, news analysis. There's a ton of great stuff, and visit it every day and see what you can learn.
Eric Bollard is Senior Fellow at Media Matters, an award-winning writer for Salon and Rolling Stone. His books include Bloggers on the Bus, published in 2009. In the coming year, Media Matters is committing itself to going after fake news in its many and influential forms. It's important work, but it won't be easy. Eric, thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief Radio, and we'll touch base again on how this whole thing is going.
Sounds great. Anytime.
Donna Redwing is a lifelong activist, a former Interfaith Alliance staff and board member, and one of my most cherished friends. As Donna prepares to retire from her most recent position as executive director of One Iowa, I am so pleased to have her sit with us for a look back and for a bit of a look ahead. Donna, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. And you know, I love speaking with you. So thank you.
There have got to be mixed feelings about retiring at such a troubled time for our nation. I feel that. Are you feeling some of that?
You know, 3.5 weeks ago, I thought I was retiring, and the world was moving forward in a way that it seemed like it should. And then we had the elections, and it feels like here in Iowa and around the nation, we've gone to hell in a handbasket.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's changed. And I think the scary part is we don't know what the changes will be. We have some idea, and I think there are people who are really frightened. But we don't know. We don't know what will come in January and beyond. And so I think this is a very, very hard time. So my first reaction was, oh, my gosh, you know, how can I retire? And then I thought, how could I not retire? Now is the time for me to be untethered from an organization. Now's the time for me to do, you know, there's inside work and there's outside work, right, mm-hmm. Walton?
Yes.
And I come from the generation of ACT UP, Queer Nation, and Lesbian Avengers. So I might have some fierce and fantastic times ahead.
That's a really great way to look at it, and I'm not at all surprised to hear you say that. You were called the most dangerous woman in America. I know you're proud of that. I'm proud of you for them calling you that. Tell our listeners how that label came about.
There was a wonderful writer for the Des Moines Register. His name was Rob Borsellini, and he covered a lot of the political and cultural things that went on in Iowa, especially during caucus season. And he was doing a piece on LGBT persons working on presidential campaigns. And this was back in the early 2000s, and I was Howard Dean's liaison to the LGBT community. And so he kind of honed in on me and made some phone calls. And when he called, I believe he called someone at the Christian Coalition, that's what they said about me. And as he dug a little deeper, though, it wasn't because I'm a mean, nasty, awful person. What he heard was that that I was dangerous because people liked me. One of the people said if I were their neighbor, they know that I would, you know, feed their dog and make sure their plants got watered. I was that kind of a person, and that's what made me dangerous. And I think there's a real lesson there. You know, when the faces and voices and stories of LGBT people get seen and heard, and we're your neighbor and your friend and your daughter and the person you like most at work, that's really dangerous to them in the culture war, because how can they then work against us?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the first times that I called you to let you know that you had been selected to receive the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award. That's enough in itself, but I want our listeners to know that the decision to give you that award was made with a group of people that I talked with about who ought to get the award. That involved President Gerald Ford, Andy Young, Bill Moyers, John Lewis, Joan Brown Campbell. So it was no little award that you were getting. Later, I called you to ask about you coming to work for Interfaith Alliance. What drew you to become involved in the Alliance enough to want to work in that agency?
Well, first of all, I hope your listeners know that anyone who meets and connects with the Reverend C. Welton Gaddy would want to work at the Interfaith Alliance. That's just a given. So that's there. To work with you was such an honor and privilege. I also, when I came to Interfaith Alliance, that was after, what, almost 20 years
right.
in the LGBT movement. And some of those years were pretty rough and tumble. You know, some of those years I was less of an advocate and more of an agitator.
Mm-hmm.
And so my introduction to Interfaith Alliance, it began to teach me another way of doing things. And the whole concept of civility and civil dialogue, the idea that we can meet people where they are, that we can disagree without being disagreeable. I think you'll remember the time Martin Marty had his conversation, his live public radio conversation, mm-hmm. and it was LGBT advocates and those who worked against us. It was pro-life and pro-choice people. It's through the Interfaith Alliance, and it's through working with people like you and connecting with folks like Martin Marty and even people like Bill Moyer that taught me that there's a different way that we can do business, and it's much, for me, much more effective.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, as I end my time here at One Iowa, not only have we, you know, created some great programming and it's a robust and wonderful organization, but I'm most known in Iowa because I have very public civil dialogue with those who work against us. And in this country, in this time, I think people are so hungry for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I credit the Interfaith Alliance with, I think, my maturation as a much kinder, more civil human being.
I'm curious, Donna, where do you think advocates of true religious freedom should be directing their energies right now?
We know that we don't know where the radical right is going, except in those places where they've told us. And they have said that they are going to try to pass RFRAs, the Statewide Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, across the country. And I think lovers of religious freedom, as our founders understood religious freedom, need to be prepared for that. And not prepared in response sometime in mid-January, but they need to start preparing now.
Mm-hmm.
When I think of the Interfaith Alliance and all of the issues that it engaged in, we know that reproductive health, for example, is going to be on the chopping block. We know that, you know, immigration, LGBT equality, we know some of the things that need to be protected. But I think first and foremost, and what really is the umbrella for all of this, is religious freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Not as an excuse to discriminate against people, but instead to protect. So I think that's where I would be putting my energies.
My guest is my great friend Donna Redwing, who's retiring this month as the executive director of One Iowa. My gosh, you're going to be freed to go anywhere you need to go and do anything you need to do and not have to report to an agency. That is scary on one side.
Yeah, it's pretty dangerous, right? Sumitra, my wife, you married us. Sumitra was recently arrested with the Standing Rock protests.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a righteous arrest, of course,
mm-hmm.
but I have to tell you, after spending a day in jail, when she left, all of the police officers came to see her and hug her and kiss her goodbye.
My goodness.
So that's the kind of, I guess, activism that I embrace.
Absolutely. Well, Donna, talk about the 4 years that you've spent in your current position.
Surprisingly, we fell in love with Iowa. And especially Des Moines. Des Moines, I like to call it the Paris of the Midwest because I am an optimist. But we fell in love with it. When people talk about Iowa Nice, they mean it. I came here as, I think, a long-term interim director. And the job was to decide whether One Iowa, which was really all about marriage issues, whether it should close its doors or was there another job. And so
mm-hmm.
I spent 3 months going around the state just listening to people. I don't think I hit all 99, but probably 50 counties, and just listened to people. And what we realized was that there needed to be an organization that advocated for equality from cradle to grave. And so we began with literally no programming. Today, we have over 200 events every year. We have programming for the parents of children as young as 3 and 4, all the way through our Gay and Gray in the Midwest programming and even our Grief Academy programming. So we're literally doing this work from cradle to grave. We educate more than 2,000 law enforcement officers every year. Our first year, you know, we'd walk into a room, there'd be 100 men with guns who didn't want to be there, and it was very, very difficult. 3 years later, we're the highest-ranked training for the Law Enforcement Academy. And so I'm really proud that we've been able to do the kind of work that, one, the community said it wanted because we listened to them, and, two, the kind of work that helps the rest of Iowa understand that we are truly one Iowa and that who we are and who we get to be is both in our hands and theirs.
I think it's increasingly important to not lose track of what happens at the state and local level in this country. You've held leadership positions both nationally and locally. How do these differ in your experience?
I think nationally, working in Washington, you start to think that that's the center of the universe, and you and I know that it's not, right?
Right.
Working nationally, I think you can impact some very important policy, but I do think you lose track or lose sight of what's important. What I love about working with a statewide organization is every day we're on the ground, every day something happens, and we know that somebody's life is better or someone's life was saved because of the work we do. It's so personal. It's so real. A state like Iowa, geographically we're a large state, but we just have a little more than 3 million folks here. We're working in rural communities. We're working in places where people would be kind of surprised that we were there. And for me, the greatest satisfaction of working locally is that you know the people you're working with, you interact with them, and you know what happens. Mm-hmm. If you do A, B, and C, you find out, you know, the D, E, and F. That's so satisfying. And if you've got it wrong, you know right away. Nobody's afraid to call you up. Nobody's afraid to walk in the door. And so you can fix it. And I think that's really important.
Donna, what advice can you offer to especially young activists out there right now at this particular time when they probably are feeling like the setbacks have been so heavy in a number of areas and would have the leaning to say, I just need to give up?
You know, if you give up, you lose. I think it's that simple. I've been doing this work in the LGBT community for 30 years, in the larger social justice movement for many more. We need to engage. We've been through this before. You know, I work with young people who have never lived in a world where their rights could be taken away, you know, mm-hmm. who've never lived in a world where because they were gay, they were illegal or immoral or mentally ill. We've been there before. We're going to get through this. It's not going to be easy. But what we have to do, and whether it's a young LGBT activist or an environmental activist or a religious liberty activist, we have to engage. If we don't, then we are ceding the game to our opponents, and I'm not willing to do that. If this old woman can get out there and do the work, I really hope that the young folks who were so inspired by Bernie Sanders, were so inspired by parts of the campaigns, they need to keep at it. They need to keep at it.
Donna, from the perspective that you have today, what advice would you give the young Donna Redwing, the person you were when you were just starting out?
Oh, my. Probably the advice would be the more you do, the more you engage, the older you get, the more you realize what you don't know.
That's easy.
And I think, you know, it's really important to know what you don't know and to play to your strengths. There are things that I am very good at, and there are things I'm not. I wish that maybe I didn't have to engage in some of the things that I'm not so good at. But I guess the greatest advice would be ask the question, you know, what makes your heart sing? What can you get up and do every morning that completes you as a person? What can you do to be the best person you can be, and then follow that? Yeah.
Donna Redwing is a lifelong activist and advocate for LGBTQ rights and religious liberty. Most recently, she's held the post of executive director at One Iowa, from which she'll be retiring this month. Donna, I know we haven't heard the last of you professionally, and I know I haven't heard the last of you as a deep personal friend. I congratulate you on this step. I look forward to what's coming next, and I also look forward to when we'll be together again soon.
Thank you.
The Right Reverend Gene Robinson is the retired Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire. In his career, Gene has displayed remarkable resilience in the face of hate and even death threats from his adversaries who felt their version of religious faith trumped his vocation as the first openly gay man to be elevated to bishop in his church. He's also been a longtime advocate for understanding across religious and cultural divides. I've been eager to hear his thoughts and feelings in the aftermath of the recent presidential election, and I'm very grateful to welcome Gene back to State of Belief Radio. Gene, thank you so much for being with us again.
Well, Wilton, it's great to be with you again. And it's actually a good thing that you waited this long to chat with me, because I've been kind of paralyzed, as I think a lot of us were, following the election, partly because I and people like me think it was a kind of catastrophic result, and also because we had such a different impression from the polling. Mm-hmm. So it's been a real shock, and the people I know and work with are still a little bit shell-shocked from this result, which still boggles my mind.
Yeah. You know, Gene, I mean, there have been elections in which I have been disappointed. I don't know that there's ever been one in which I simply felt fear as well as disappointment. What kinds of fears and feelings have people brought to you since November the 8th?
First, let me say this. I happened to have the opportunity to go to Berlin back in September, mm-hmm. and I was struck when I was there of how many very intentional reminders the German people have erected to remind themselves of what they did back in the 30s and 40s. Mm. And I must admit, after this campaign, I think I have a lot more sympathy for the German people in the lead-up to Hitler. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying that Donald Trump is Hitler or that we are necessarily headed in that direction, but there is enough similarity in what we've seen to make me at least think of the German experience. Mm-hmm. You know, I and a lot of people just sat around for a while thinking something would stop this man, mm-hmm. thinking that something would disqualify him or some person would rise to stop him. And then one day you wake up and he's the nominee, and then a couple of months later you wake up and he's the president-elect. Mm-hmm. And now I understand how good people probably thought that somebody would stop Hitler, but it wasn't them that needed to stop him. Somebody else would do it.
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm hearing the most from the people that I work with, and especially those who are experiencing such fear, Muslims and the poor and people of color and LGBT people and women everywhere. Those people are just living terrified. And if you happen to be an undocumented person in this country, you know, I actually know of some of those people who have gone into hiding and are expecting there to be a roundup and a mass deportation. I don't think we know how this is going to play out yet, because he's so reneged on so many of his promises already. Mm-hmm. But it's a frightening time, and I can't remember, you know, I'll be 70 next May, and I cannot remember a time like this, sort of like you were saying, times when I was disappointed, yes, mm-hmm. but not fearful for myself, for people like me, and for the country.
Yeah. I think, Gene, one reason that I was so interested in us getting together to talk as soon as possible was so much of your ministry happened in an adversarial environment. What lessons did you learn during that time that could be helpful to many of us today?
You know, I think that perhaps the greatest learning that I had during that time when so much hatred and anger and frustration and even evil was coming my way, the thing I think I learned the most was that behind all of that is fear. And what I learned to do when I was attacked, especially if I was in that person's presence, was to almost in a nanosecond ask myself the question, okay, so he's just said this. What is he afraid of that causes him to say that? Mm-hmm. As opposed to dealing with the thing that actually gets voiced, is to ask the question, what is the fear behind that? And then seek to address that fear in a way that convinces that person that they need not be fearful. Mm-hmm. So here's how I apply that to what has just happened in this country. I think that many of Donald Trump's voters are not particularly racist or misogynist or anti-Muslim or anything like that. I think they're fearful, and I think they feel left behind. And if you're feeling that way, if you feel your country and your society has left you behind, that somehow politically correct language is a put-down of you, is a kind of condescending lesson that the dominant culture is trying to force down your throat, then you're going to be fearful. You're going to be fearful that you're losing the country that you love, which is why the Make America Great Again was such an effective slogan. And so I think that people like us who did not vote for Donald Trump need to be a little bit humble here and to say, what do these people have to say to us that it's very clear they don't think we've listened to before? And what is the fear that is driving this turn of events? Mm-hmm. And what needs to happen to make them understand that they need not be fearful?
I think that's a great suggestion and observation. I just have to be honest with you. I see that as being a dangerous way to go forward, because I'm not at all sure, Gene, that he's not going to disappoint all the people that voted for him. And those who think they're now moving to the front of the line and they're going to have jobs plenty and he's going to be really sympathetic with the little person in the nation. And right now, with the changes he's making, he doesn't show any signs of doing that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the question that we're all asking is, how long will it take for the people who voted for him, how long will it take for them to realize they've been conned?
Right.
And I don't think it's going to be anytime soon, mm-hmm. because they have cut him so much slack. Mm-hmm. They have allowed him to say and do the most outrageous thing, and it just rolls off of him like Teflon.
Yeah.
And so I think one of the questions is going to be, how long will it take for them to understand, you know, for instance, you know what, The coal mining jobs are not coming back to West Virginia. Mm-hmm. That is just a fact. Mm-hmm. And how long will those coal miners that he told he would bring their jobs back, how long will they give him to meet that promise? And then the accompanying question is, what can we do for those coal miners? I would say that they chose the wrong solution to their problem, but they have a problem, mm-hmm. and we ignore it to our peril.
Right. Gene, I know you're a bridge builder, and you've always been someone who's committed to reaching out to other people. But I get the distinct sense, since this election, that many of the political right are actually sitting there with a kind of now what confusion, even as many of the left are feeling pretty helpless. So what can we say about that chasm and how we bridge that chasm?
I think that is the conundrum of this time. I mean, there's several things working here. One is that we are actually sorting ourselves out into neighborhoods and locations and even states where we live, so as to only come into contact with people who think like us. Mm-hmm. That, right out of the get-go, is a dangerous and discouraging thing. Second of all, I think I would go a step further than saying we only watch the news that gives us the kind of news we want to hear, although that's really true. I think the most frightening thing that has come out of this turn of events is that there seems to be a large part of the population who does not care what the facts are.
Absolutely.
And if we're not going to deal in the truth, then I mean, I can't even think about that for very long, or else I just start feeling hopeless, right?
Sure.
I mean, you might have a chance of building those bridges if you could at least agree about some basic truths, some basic accounts of what is happening, what is not happening. But if you're going to just defy the facts and believe that they're not true, mm-hmm. I'm not sure where the common ground is. And so I think we're left with finding ways to interact with and be in touch with people who are different from us.
Yeah.
I mean, so when we write an op-ed, instead of sending it to the New York Times Post, you know, we ought to be sending it to the paper in Wichita or San Antonio or Boise, Idaho, and seeing if they will print it. And try to get some sort of conversation going. But because I think if we continue not to have any kind of contact with those people, we will not undo this anytime soon.
Gene, the question that really just presses on my mind a lot, and I wish it didn't because I'm disturbed by the question itself, but is it time for people to come together, or are these things about this election things that are just too extreme for us to treat as normal politics?
Yeah, there's an awful lot about this that is so alarming at such a depth that you have to wonder about that. But here's this helpful thing, right? I think this ought to be a time for people of faith. I think. And I'm not talking about Christian. I'm talking about a multi-faith, diverse, intergenerational group of people who who begin to claim a set of values in God's name. I think one of the most disturbing things about this election was, I think I got this right, I think it's 81% of people who identify as evangelicals voted for Donald Trump.
Right.
Which says to me that actually they don't have religious values, they just have political values.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been suffering under the illusion that it was their religion that was driving them. And I think that just turns out not to be true. And so in light of that, it seems like a great opportunity for people of faith, Jews and Christians and Muslims and Sikhs and Hindus and people of no faith but people of goodwill to begin to organize and to raise these issues and conversations about values and what we stand for. I think that phrase about making America great again, I mean, it just exposed what the meaning of great meant to those people, which was mostly white, mostly patriarchal, mostly Western men, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so where is the alternative? And who's making the case for a respect for all religions, a respect for all people, a respect for all genders and gender identities, LGBT people, poor people, the list goes on and on. But I think we're too much in our own silos, and we have simply got to band together, or else this thing is going to kill us.
As I would expect, that's great admonition, and I think we ought to just leave it right there for now. But we've got a lot more talking to do in
yes,
the days ahead. The Right Reverend Gene Robinson was the first openly gay man to be elevated to bishop in the Episcopal Church. He's the author of several invaluable books, including God Believes in Love, Straight Talk About Gay Marriage, and In the Eye of the Storm, Swept to the Center by God. Today, Gene serves as senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. He has always been very eager to join us on State of Belief Radio, for which we are grateful. And, Gene, it's just always great to have a conversation with you, and this one was no exception with you being on State of Belief Radio again.
Thank you so much, Welton, and I want to wish you and everyone listening a wonderful holiday season.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We rely on your support to be able to continue this important work. Now, if you've heard something that you found to be helpful on today's show, I urge you to share that with others who might also benefit from hearing it. It's really easy to do that on Facebook and Twitter. You can also direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes and in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until next week, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was. Mm-hmm.